Hello, and welcome to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. We'll start with the death notices and move on to business and sports, then the opinions and editorials, and finish up with today's horoscopes, Dear Abby, and the comics. The death notices from today's Arizona Republic: Judy K. Clements, age 81, no town given. Ruth Eileen Holland Martineau, age 102, no town given. And James McDowell, age 82, from Paradise Valley. Turning now to business, OpenAI, SoftBank invest in $1 billion in SB Energy, funds to be used for expanding Powering Stargate initiative. OpenAI and SoftBank Group will invest $500 million each in SB Energy to expand data center and power infrastructure for their Stargate initiative, SB Energy said on January 9th. SB Energy, a SoftBank-owned company, will build and operate OpenAI's previously announced 1.2 gigawatt data center in Milam County, Texas. SB Energy will also become a customer of OpenAI, using its APIs and deploying ChatGPT for employees. Stargate is a $500 billion multi-year initiative to build AI data centers for training and inference, backed by major investors, including Oracle. President Donald Trump backed the initiative when the companies announced the plan in January 2025. Tech companies are investing directly in power infrastructure as energy access becomes a critical constraint on AI expansion, with a push for larger and more numerous data centers driving electricity demand higher. SB Energy is developing several data center campuses, with initial facilities expected to begin service this year. The partnership accelerates our delivery of advanced AI data center campuses and associated energy infrastructure at the scale required to advance Stargate and secure America's AI future, SB Energy co-CEO Rich Hosfield said. The data center construction boom has also prompted major players, including Meta Platforms, to allocate unprecedented sums to infrastructure projects that require massive investments in chips, power, cooling, and servers. Meanwhile, OpenAI faces rising expenses for training and operating its AI systems amid intensifying competition from Alphabet's Google. CEO Sam Altman told staff late last year that the company has entered a code red mode, focused on enhancing ChatGPT while delaying launches of other products, as it moved to counter Gemini's growing traction. Continuing with the business section, industry's partner to push for self-driving. The short history of the self-driving car industry has been littered with expensive failures and endless delays, but tech suppliers, chip makers, including NVIDIA, and some automakers are betting on AI and a web of partnerships to spark new progress. Many interested automakers, however, still have major questions. Apart from concerns about high costs and scalability, they want to know if there's enough customer demand to make money out of an expensive wager. Vehicles that drive themselves would change the transportation landscape, but making such a technology safe for public roads has been harder and much more expensive than expected. While a few companies such as Alphabet's Waymo and Tesla have decided to do it themselves, veterans such as General Motors and Ford Motor have abandoned their in-house efforts for fully autonomous vehicles. At the CES show in Las Vegas last week, AWS and German supplier Automovio announced a deal to support the commercial rollout of self-driving vehicles, while autonomous truck firm Kodiak AI and Bosch said they have partnered to ramp up manufacturing of autonomous truck hardware and sensors. AI chip company NVIDIA rolled out its next-generation platform, which will be used in a robo-taxi alliance announced by Lucid Group, Nuro, and Uber. Powered by NVIDIA's chips, Mercedes-Benz said this week it will launch a new advanced driver assistance system in the United States later this year that lets its vehicles operate autonomously on city streets under driver supervision. The propulsive force behind self-driving technology, artificial intelligence, is also coming into its own as a development tool, offering hopes of mitigating high costs. AI and generative AI are acting as a big accelerant for the industry because it actually allows a significant amount of development and validation with significantly fewer resources, said Asghar Tokumu, General Manager for Automotive and Manufacturing at Amazon's cloud unit, Amazon Web Services. Western automakers are also under pressure to keep up with China's push to lead the development and adoption of autonomous driving. In December, the Chinese government approved two cars with Level 3 autonomous capabilities, which allows hands-off driving. The auto industry has defined five levels of autonomous driving, from cruise control at Level 1 to fully self-driving without a human minder needed at Level 5. Still, Jochen Hanebeck, CEO of German chipmaker Infineon, cautioned against market fantasy that somehow fully self-driving cars could become commonplace within a few years. Rather than risk fresh investments in fully self-driving, major automakers want revenue-generating driver assistance technology, known as Level 2, but that is already available, but requires drivers to pay constant attention, he said. I don't see, really, now a tsunami flowing toward Level 5, Hanebeck said. In recent months, there's been a flurry of small robo-taxi deployments announced in China, the United States, Europe, and the Middle East. But Jeremy McLean, head of System and Software at Aumovio's Autonomous Mobility Unit, said that expanding the areas they cover requires more data, fleets, and logistics, which is costly and expensive. The self-driving car industry is long on hype. Tesla CEO Elon Musk promised in 2019 that a year later, the electric vehicle maker would have 1 million self-driving cars on the road. But Tesla launched a small robo-taxi trial service only last year, 6 years after Musk's bold prediction. The problem was that cars face billions of potential unexpected incidents, or edge cases, that can easily fool self-driving vehicles. One example often touted by experts is that if a human driver sees a ball rolling into the street, they automatically slow because it might be pursued by a child. But a self-driving car will react only when it sees the child. After the first self-driving bubble burst, major automakers, including Ford and GM, abandoned money-losing autonomous vehicle units. The demise of GM's Cruise was accelerated by an incident in which it struck and dragged a pedestrian 20 feet. But Ali Khani, general manager of the automotive team at NVIDIA, said AI has enabled advances to address key weaknesses in self-driving technology. There's some foundational pieces of technology that make us feel like we're there, Connie said. Morgan Stanley analysts, in a note on CES, said that while NVIDIA's new Alfa Romeo platform for self-driving would give legacy car makers a leg up and help them pressure Tesla, the EV maker was years ahead. That said, many in the industry see NVIDIA, whose platform is open source, as a convenient place for Tesla rivals to gather. And the last item in this business section, China can narrow tech gap with U.S. Lack of chip-making tools still a hurdle. China can narrow its technological gap with the United States, driven by growing risk-taking and innovation. Though the lack of advanced chip-making tools is hobbling the sector, the country's leading artificial intelligence researchers said on January 10th. China's so-called AI tiger startups, Minimax and Zipu AI, had strong debuts on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange this week, reflecting growing confidence in the sector as Beijing fast-tracks AI and chip listings to bolster domestic alternatives to advanced U.S. technology. Yao Shunyu, a former senior researcher at ChatGPT maker OpenAI, who was named technology giant Tencent's chief AI scientist in December, said there was a high likelihood of a Chinese firm becoming the world's leading AI company in the next 3 to 5 years, but said the lack of advanced chip-making machines was the main technical hurdle. Currently, we have a significant advantage in electricity and infrastructure. The main bottlenecks are production capacity, including lithography machines and the software ecosystem, Yao said at an AI conference in Beijing. China has completed a working prototype of an extreme ultraviolet lithography machine potentially capable of producing cutting-edge semiconductor chips that rival the West's, Reuters reported last month. However, the machine has not yet produced working chips and may not do so until 2030, people with knowledge of the matter told Reuters. Yao and other Chinese industry leaders at the Beijing conference on January 10th also acknowledged that the United States maintains an advantage in computing power due to its hefty investments in infrastructure. The U.S. computer infrastructure is likely one or two orders of magnitude larger than ours or other platforms. They're investing heavily in next-generation research, said Lin Junyang, the technical leader for Alibaba's flagship Qwen large language model. We, on the other hand, are relatively strapped for cash. Delivery alone likely consumes the majority of our computer infrastructure, Lin said, during a panel discussion at the AGI Next Frontier Summit held by the Beijing Key Laboratory of Foundational Models at Tsinghua University. Lin said China's limited resources have spurred its researchers to be innovative, particularly through algorithm hardware co-design, which enables AI firms to run large models on smaller, inexpensive hardware. Tang Ji, founder of Zipu AI, raised $558 million in its IPO, also highlighted the willingness of younger Chinese AI entrepreneurs to embrace high-risk ventures, a trait traditionally associated with Silicon Valley, as a positive development. And turning now to the sports section of today's Arizona Republic, big headline on the beginning of the sports section, Arizona acquires Arenado in trade. D-backs give up young pitcher for veteran third baseman. The Diamondbacks have acquired third baseman Nolan Arenado from the St. Louis Cardinals, a move that amounts to a low-cost gamble that the former superstar can still provide some late-career value. The Diamondbacks are on the hook for $11 million, $5 million this year and $6 million next year, of the $42 million remaining on Arenado's contract, which runs through 2027. In exchange, the Diamondbacks are giving up right-hander Jack Martinez, who was the club's eighth-round pick last year out of Arizona State. Martinez has yet to make his professional debut. The Athletics' Katie Wu was first to report the impending deal. Arenado, 34, is coming off a brutal season in which he hit 237, 289, 377. He played in only 23 games in the second half due to a shoulder injury. It was the second consecutive disappointing year for Arenado, who for much of his career was viewed as one of the better third basemen in baseball. Arenado is a 10-time Gold Glove winner, an 8-time All-Star, and a 5-time Silver Slugger, who has finished in the top 10 of MVP voting 10 times. The Cardinals have been trying to find a team to take Arenado for at least the past two off-seasons. They had an agreement in place last winter to send him to the Houston Astros, but Arenado used his no-trade clause to block the deal. In a related story by Nick Picoro from the Arizona Republic, Diamondbacks' new addition Arenado could be a natural fit. In acquiring Nolan Arenado, the Diamondbacks might not be landing the superstar third baseman of yesteryear, the one who finished in the top 10 of MVP voting 6 times, including as recently as 2022, the one who might be headed to Cooperstown. But even if his offensive production remains at levels of the past couple of seasons, that is, average at best, the Diamondbacks still see things to like that make him a good fit for their roster. Arenado, who turns 35 in April, remains a strong defensive third baseman. No small thing for a Diamondbacks team that had success leaning into its defense in the second half of last year. Once a platinum glove caliber defender, Arenado hasn't been that good in recent seasons, but still grades out as well above average per multiple defensive metrics. He also provides a sort of safety net for the Diamondbacks' young position players, his presence perhaps taking pressure off Blaze Alexander and Jordan Lawler. Arenado will cut into their playing time, but he also will allow the Diamondbacks to ease them into larger roles at their own pace. Both Alexander and Lawler figure to be options in the outfield as well, including left field, where the Diamondbacks will be without Lourdes Gurriel Jr. to open the year as he works his way back from knee surgery. Lawler, who played center field in winter ball this offseason, is likely to see even more time in the outfield than Alexander. The Diamondbacks also like everything Arenado brings off the field. His energy, his work ethic, his passion for winning. He's always seemed like the sort of player whose emotions and energy, surroundings and production were all tied together. And there is curiosity about whether exiting a rebuild in St. Louis and joining a team intent on winning in Arizona could jumpstart his bat again. Arenado said he's energized by the trade. He had to approve the deal by waiving his no-trade clause. Arenado would have a long way to go to get back to what he was offensively. In 2022, when he finished third in the MVP race, he hit .293, .358, .533, with 30 homers and 103 RBIs. He led the National League with 7.9 wins above replacement, per Baseball Reference. But his production has fallen significantly in recent seasons. Over the past 3 years, he's hit just .261, .312, .413 in a combined 403 games. He hit just .237 last year in a season hampered by a shoulder injury. That diminished production drove down the cost for the Diamondbacks. Not only did they part with just a mid-level pitching prospect, right-hander Jack Martinez, their eighth-round pick from last year, who has yet to make his debut and likely projects as a reliever, they are paying only $11 million of the $42 million left on Arenado's deal, which runs through 2027. If Arenado finds his old form, the Diamondbacks will be ecstatic. But if he ends up more of a down lineup, defense-oriented clubhouse leading type, they seem content with that too. Also from the front page of the sports section, Suns fans celebrate Booker's new shoes. Devin Booker knows what he did. His Phoenix Suns fan let him know about it too. Booker originally dropped his Nike Book Ones in Miami in December 2023. That didn't go over well with folks in the Valley. With his Book Twos coming out this month, Booker made up for it by holding a pop-up store event on Sunday, January 11th, in collaboration with Foot Locker at 2nd and Jackson Streets, across from Mortgage Matchup Center in Phoenix. "It was important to me to make sure that the city was involved," Booker said. "I think that's one thing I probably regretted from the Book One, was the drop was in Miami, and I heard a lot about that from my Phoenix faithful. We wanted to do an activation here in the hometown and just get the community involved, get everybody in one place to celebrate the moment." The scheduled six-hour event started in the afternoon and rolled right up to the beginning of the Suns-Washington Wizards game, which Phoenix won, 112-93. "It's cool, man. Finally, Nike showing out for Book," said Suns fan Andres Breziado at the event. "We were waiting for this, the Ones, but they did it in Miami. The whole thing over here. It's cool." Thousands of fans lined up around the block for the event, where the black and orange Nike Book 2s Rising and all-orange Phoenix sneakers were available for purchase. "The shoes, honestly, 10 out of 10, said Suns fan Senad Kokic, as he bought the Phoenix sneakers that are scheduled for release on January 16th. "The event? I don't think Arizona has had anything like this. I don't think so," he said. Nike is selling the Rising for $145 and Phoenix for $155 on its website. "These shoes are really fire," said Suns fan D-Rock, that's his Twitter handle, as he bought the Phoenix sneakers. The event also featured a makeshift court for pickup games and a photo area where fans could take a photo and have it transposed onto a background with the Licensed for Skill Nike Book 2 theme. Got some cool events out here in Phoenix, Suns fan Miguel Morales said. The Suns are playing good. Got to get that gear, you know. Standing beside Morales, a smiling Breziado said, yeah, it does feel better that they're doing good. The pop-up event took fans inside Booker's advertisement theme for the shoe. As one walked into a trailer, black sport coats and white dress shirts hung on either side with Nike Book 2 sneakers below. Then there was a table with 1980s tech, like a retro monitor, walkie-talkie, gloves, audio cassette tapes, and an old-school cassette player. Foot Locker employees took fans' orders and relayed them to a truck where all the shoes were stored. Donovan Moore and Kochik walked out of the trailer hyped with sneakers in hands and smiles on faces. Moore snagged the black and orange Nike Book 2 Rising sneakers. Last of the size 11, too, Moore said. Last of the 11s. From San Diego, Moore was impressed by the pop-up and the Book 2s. Pretty fire shoe. Pretty awesome event, obviously for the community, Moore said. Turning to football now, NFL mock draft. Cards miss out on top quarterbacks with number 3 pick. This is written by Theo Mackey from the Arizona Republic. Over the next 3 months, the Arizona Cardinals will make 3 crucial decisions, each shaping the future of their organization. First up, their ongoing head coach search. Then in March, they'll likely determine Kyler Murray's future. Finally, in April, they'll make the number 3 pick in the NFL draft, unless they trade that selection. Since general manager Monty Ossenfort took over in 2023, the Cardinals have had mixed success with high-end draft picks. That first season, he traded away the number 3 pick, which the Texans used on all-pro edge rusher Will Anderson. Ossenfort, though, helped the franchise with the selection of Paris Johnson Jr., who has become a foundational piece for the Cardinals at left tackle. A year later, Ossenfort used the number 4 pick on Marvin Harrison Jr., who's not yet lived up to his pre-draft hype, but is nonetheless a key part of the Cardinals' offense. So, who will the Cardinals pick in 2026? And can they find their next franchise quarterback? That depends on how the rest of the draft unfolds. Here is our latest top 10 mock draft, with no trades. Number 1. Las Vegas Raiders, Fernando Mendoza, quarterback from Indiana. After outshining Dante Moore in the college football playoff semifinals, Mendoza is now minus 1,200 to be the first overall pick, per DraftKings. He's thrown for 41 touchdowns, with just 6 interceptions this year, putting up one of the best collegiate seasons since Joe Burrow in 2019. It's the type of pick that the Raiders hope will revitalize a moribund franchise. Number 2, New York Jets. Dante Moore, quarterback from Oregon. Mendoza going first overall likely leaves the Jets with Moore as their consolation prize, but there are a few important caveats. For one, Moore could still decide to return to Oregon, enticed by deep NIL coffers. And even if he does declare for the draft, he's not quite a guarantee to go number 2 overall. The Jets are committed to a multi-year rebuild and could opt for a non-quarterback if they don't see Moore as their future. Number 3, Arizona Cardinals, Arvell Reese, edge, at Ohio State. Here lies the problem for the Cardinals. Had they lost one more game this season, they would be in position to draft Mendoza as Kyler Murray's successor. Instead, they'll be out of position for a quarterback, assuming the top 2 picks go as expected. Alabama's Ty Simpson is seen as the 3rd best quarterback prospect in the class, but he's expected to be a late round or early 2nd round pick. The silver lining, though, is that the Cardinals can draft the best non-quarterback in the class, whether that's Reese or an offensive line prospect. Number 4, Tennessee Titans. Carnell Tate, WR, Ohio State. Tennessee, on the other hand, is in an ideal position. The Titans could need pass catching to help support Cam Ward and will have their pick of Tate or Arizona State's Jordan Tyson. It would be hard for them to go wrong at number 4. Number 5, New York Giants, Caleb Downs from Ohio State. If positional value weren't a consideration, Downs might be the first player off the board in April. Safeties don't go number one overall, but he could still sneak inside the top five, rounding out a run of three straight Buckeyes. Number six, Cleveland Browns, Spencer Fano, OT from Utah. Fano has played almost exclusively at right tackle in college, driving down his draft value. Still, he's the top tackle prospect on the board, which makes him an option for the Cardinals at number three. If he gets this far, Cleveland could be the benefactor, helping rebuild an offensive line that will be ravaged by free agent departures this spring. Number seven, Washington Commanders. Reuben Bain Jr., edge, Miami. Washington needs all the defensive help it can get and will likely be in a position to draft an impact edge rusher here. Bain's short arm length will be a topic of discussion when the combine rolls around, but he's a powerful pass rusher who finished this season with 8.5 sacks. Number eight, New Orleans Saints, Jordan Tyson, WR, Arizona State. All of a sudden, it's an exciting time in New Orleans. For much of the season, the Saints were one of the worst teams in the NFL, as expected. But down the stretch, they found life behind quarterback Tyler Shough and a surprising defense. Tyson could be the next key ingredient, giving Shough a second high-level receiving option alongside Chris Olave. Number nine, Kansas City Chiefs, Jeremiah Love, running back from Notre Dame. The Chiefs desperately need to rebuild their offensive identity this offseason, starting with a renewed commitment to the running game. There's no better way to start than with Love, who might be the best offensive player in the class. And number 10, Cincinnati Bengals, David Bailey, edge, Texas Tech. Any and all defensive help is needed in Cincinnati, especially if Trey Hendrickson departs in free agency. Bailey led FBS with 14.5 sacks this season at Texas Tech and would give the Bengals much-needed juice off the edge if Hendrickson leaves. And more football news. Cardinals are also pursuing John Harbaugh. This is written by Theo Mackey from the Arizona Republic. The Arizona Cardinals are among the teams interested in John Harbaugh, according to an ESPN report. Since he was fired by the Baltimore Ravens last week, Harbaugh has been considered the crown jewel of this year's crop of head coaching candidates. In 18 years with Baltimore, Harbaugh made 12 playoff appearances, won 13 playoff games, and claimed one Super Bowl title. Each of those marks is more than the Cardinals have accomplished in the Super Bowl era. They have reached the playoffs 9 times with 6 wins and 0 Super Bowl titles. Harbaugh was fired by the Ravens after a disappointing 8-9 season in which Baltimore was considered a preseason Super Bowl contender. Still, his firing led to immediate interest across the league, including from some organizations that do not yet have head coach openings, according to multiple reports. As of January 12th, the Atlanta Falcons were the only team to have announced an interview with Harbaugh. However, Harbaugh has conducted preliminary and extensive phone calls with 5 organizations, according to the ESPN report. In addition to the Cardinals, those organizations are the New York Giants, the Tennessee Titans, Cleveland Browns, and the Las Vegas Raiders. The Falcons and Giants are widely considered to be favorites for Harbaugh's services. The Falcons are owned by Arthur Blank, who is among the league's more respected owners. The Giants, meanwhile, are among the league's marquee franchises and have a young franchise quarterback, Jackson Dart. For now, though, the Cardinals are in contention, as the 63-year-old Harbaugh is expected to coach in 2026 rather than taking a year off. And Tomlin and Steelers are parting ways after 19 seasons and 201 wins. A late and unexpected vacancy has spun the NFL's offseason coaching carousel into overdrive. Mike Tomlin is stepping down from the Pittsburgh Steelers after a 19-year run leading the storied organization, the team announced Tuesday. With a career record of 201, 126, 2, including the postseason, Tomlin stood not only as the longest tenured active coach, but also one of the winningest figures in NFL history. His 193 career regular season victories are tied with fellow former Steelers coach Chuck Knoll for ninth all-time. Now, a franchise that has only known three head coaches since 1969 will be facing a rare moment of upheaval. The opening will be the ninth vacancy in the NFL this offseason. Speculation about Tomlin's future had lingered in a campaign in which Pittsburgh didn't seal a playoff spot until its Week 18 victory over the Baltimore Ravens. After a 30-6 loss to the Houston Texans in the wildcard round, which marked the largest deficit in a home playoff defeat in franchise history, Tomlin shrugged off questions about what was next for both him and the organization. "I'm not even in that mindset as I sit here tonight," said Tomlin, who had been under contract through 2026 with a club option for an additional year due to be exercised by March. "I'm more in the mindset of what transpired in this stadium and certainly what we did or didn't do." Hired in 2007 at 34 years old to succeed future Hall of Fame coach Bill Cowher, Tomlin led the organization to a Super Bowl title in just his second year at the helm. He quickly became the gold standard for stability, as the Steelers never suffered a losing season during his reign, a stretch that was unmatched by any other coach to start his career. But postseason disappointments became a recurring theme of the latter half of his tenure. The loss to the Texans was Tomlin's seventh consecutive postseason defeat, leaving him tied for the worst playoff losing streak of any coach in league history. Pittsburgh, which has not won the playoffs since the 2016 season, also now stands alone as the only team in league history to lose five consecutive playoff games by double digits. After Monday's defeat, Steelers quarterback Aaron Rodgers came to the defense of Tomlin and Green Bay Packers coach Matt LaFleur, who had also coached the four-time NFL MVP and faced uncertainty regarding his standing after his own team's wildcard exit. "This league has changed a lot in my 21 years," Rodgers said. "You know, when you hear conversation about the Mike Tomlins of the world, the Matt LaFleurs of the world, those are just two that I've played for. When I first got in the league, there wouldn't be a conversation about whether those guys were on the hot seat." And one more football article here. Rodgers' retirement call looms after loss. Written by Jarrett Bell, columnist for USA Today. "Thanks for the memories, Aaron Rodgers. If that was it, the last hurrah in a 21-year career that will ultimately be stamped with a Hall of Fame induction, you certainly deserved a better send-off than the pounding inflicted by the Houston Texans on Monday night." And again, it was fitting enough. No, the season of hope for Rodgers with the Pittsburgh Steelers, where he joined forces with the likes of Mike Tomlin, Cam Hayward, and T.J. Watt, didn't quite turn out to produce a made-for-Hollywood ending, but at least he gave it a shot. Sure, the standard is the standard. For a man with four NFL MVP awards and a Super Bowl title on his resume, even if it was 15 years ago, making a cameo appearance in the NFL playoffs was undoubtedly half-empty. It was fair enough if there was going to be some magical turn back the clock run in these unpredictable NFL playoffs. The 42-year-old legend had to start by beating a team that includes a gang of maulers who formulate arguably the league's best defense. Turns out that was way too much to ask. Instead, Rodgers was issued a cruel reality check from the Texans, who turned two Rodgers turnovers into second-half touchdowns to add insult to the 30-6 shellacking in the AFC wildcard playoff game. Maybe this was the takeaway message from the Texans. Go ahead, just retire already. Too bad. Maybe the last throw Rodgers will ever make as an active NFL quarterback was intercepted by Kalen Bullock and returned 50 yards for a pick six with just under 3 minutes to play. Mercy rule stuff indeed. Earlier in the fourth quarter, Rodgers, who operated for much of the night with all the space afforded in a phone booth, fumbled as he was pummeled in a collapsing pocket. Sheldon Rankin snatched up the football and rumbled 31 yards with a big man TD return. and other images of frustration, the sacks, the misfires, miscommunication with receivers, DK Metcalf's drop, and the net effect was something that probably led many viewers of the primetime broadcast to cover their eyes, or maybe turn the TV off, after a full slate of nail-biters over the weekend to open the NFL playoffs. It seemed especially cruel that Rodgers went down in the pure beatdown of a blowout. The Steelers were outscored 23-0 in the fourth quarter, rather than with some last-minute drama. It was not the ideal way for Rodgers to be remembered. He couldn't even lead the Steelers to a touchdown, the first time that's happened for Rodgers in the playoffs, and converting on third downs was almost as challenging. On a night the franchise lost a seventh consecutive postseason game, he was not the savior to reverse that pattern. Rodgers couldn't run, couldn't hide, and certainly could not compete like he used to, as dominant D linemen Will Anderson Jr., Danielle Hunter, Denico Autry, and Rankins kept messing up the plan. Rodgers was sacked four times and finished with a 50.8 passer rating, and it was worse than those numbers suggest. Hey, not every legend rides off like John Elway in a hail of Super Bowl confetti. Most, like Rodgers, have to go out the hard way, reminded of how far removed they are from their prime. Of course, Rodgers hasn't definitely declared that this is and it and that he will retire. Understandably, in the immediate aftermath of Monday night's game, he would not as much as acknowledge that his brutal evening and the collapse was hardly all on the quarterback would affect the decision about his future. No, I'm not going to make any emotional decisions, Rodgers said. Disappointed? Obviously. It was such a fun year. A lot of adversity, but a lot of fun. It's been a great year, you know. Obviously, in my life, and this is a really good part of that. You know, coming here and being a part of the team. So it's disappointing to be sitting here with the season over. Stay tuned. If you followed Rodgers' saga, you realize it could be a while, weeks, perhaps months, before he makes a decision on whether to return. While he sent signals early on after joining the Steelers in June that he was likely in his final season, he has more recently softened that stance and left the door open to playing the back half of his two-year contract in 2026. There were notable victories, for sure. Rodgers led the Steelers to the AFC North crown, even if it was enabled by a missed field goal on the last snap of the NFL's final regular season game. He made it back to the postseason for the first time in 4 years, and in a violent occupation where participants are often carted off or hobble off on crutches. Rodgers, two seasons removed from a torn Achilles, walked off the field at Acrisure Stadium on his own power. In any event, he can take all of that with him to a darkness retreat as his retirement decision again begs for deep contemplation. Last year, Rodgers didn't officially commit to joining the Steelers until June, after weeks of courting by Tomlin. Now, a decision includes the perspective of meshing with a Steelers culture that is such a contrast to what he experienced in two seasons with the New York Jets. Even so, there's the matter of whether he has the desire to try it again. Surely, Rodgers doesn't want to go out like Monday night. Yet, he should also realize that if he decides to come back, next time might be even worse. And time now to turn to the opinion section of today's Arizona Republic. The first opinion, international visitor surcharge is good for the Grand Canyon. At the start of 2026, Grand Canyon National Park received a gift that will outlast any season, a more durable way to protect one of Earth's greatest natural wonders. The gift didn't arrive wrapped under the tree, but rather by plane and tour bus. Travelers from Europe, Asia, and distant corners of the globe, drawn to a landscape that defies description. Beginning New Year's Day, those international visitors were asked to contribute a bit more to help care for the place they traveled so far to see. Under a new policy, overseas visitors to some of the nation's most popular parks, including the Grand Canyon, are now paying a $100 surcharge on top of the base entrance fee. With an estimated 30% to 40% of annual visitors coming from overseas, some gateway communities worry that this change could deter visitors and hurt local economies. The evidence suggests the opposite. This surcharge is a smart investment in the Grand Canyon and in the Arizona communities that depend on it. International visitors already demonstrate just how much they value America's national parks. At the Grand Canyon, roughly 1.5 million visitors each year come from other countries. They fill hotels in Tusayan, Williams, and Flagstaff, eat at local restaurants, book guides, and support thousands of jobs across northern Arizona. A 2025 study from the Property and Environment Research Center, the PERC, P-E-R-C, modeled the economic impact of an international visitor surcharge at Yellowstone National Park. It provides a clear benchmark for what the Grand Canyon can expect. Like the Grand Canyon, Yellowstone is a world-famous destination with significant international visitation. Yellowstone welcomes roughly 600,000 to 700,000 overseas visitors every year, about 15% of total visitation. Using Yellowstone data, PERC modeled the effects of a $100 international visitor surcharge. The results are striking, finding that it would generate approximately $55 million in additional annual revenue at Yellowstone alone, nearly four times the park's current entrance fee revenue. At the same time, the impact on visitation would be small. Total visitation was projected to decline by only about 1.3%, entirely from overseas visitors. The reason is simple. For international travelers, park entrance fees are a tiny share of total trip costs. The average overseas visitor to Yellowstone spends about $4,500 on their trip. Against that backdrop, a $100 surcharge barely moves the needle. Compared with Yellowstone, an even larger share of Grand Canyon visitors come from abroad. Applying Yellowstone's findings suggests that the Grand Canyon could generate tens of millions of dollars annually in new revenue while seeing little meaningful drop in visitation. That revenue could not come at a more important time. Aging infrastructure at the Grand Canyon is no longer an abstract concern. It is already disrupting visitors and hurting local economies. The most visible example is the Trans Canyon Waterline, a 12.5-mile system built in 1960s that supplies water to the South Rim. The waterline has exceeded its expected lifespan and fails frequently, requiring constant and expensive repairs. In December, a series of major breaks left no water being pumped to the South Rim, forcing the indefinite closure of all major park hotels, including El Tovar, Bright Angel Lodge, Maswick Lodge, and Yavapai Lodge. Overnight visitors disappeared overnight, and gateway communities were undoubtedly feeling the impact. A $208 million rehabilitation project, funded partly by visitors' fees, is underway and expected to be completed in 2027. But the lesson is clear. All has an upkeep cost. Without reliable funding to maintain water systems, roads, trails, wastewater facilities, and employee housing, tourist icons like the Grand Canyon can quickly be brought to a standstill. This is where the international visitor surcharge matters. Under federal law, 80% of entrance fee revenue stays in the park where it is collected. That means money paid by international visitors at the Grand Canyon will largely be reinvested directly into Grand Canyon National Park. Park managers can use it for maintenance, visitor services, staffing, and capital projects without waiting for political gridlock in Washington to end. For gateway communities, this stability is not a threat. It is an economic safeguard. Well-maintained infrastructure keeps hotels open, trails accessible, and visitors flowing through local businesses year after year. There's also nothing unusual about this approach. Around the world, iconic destinations routinely charge higher fees to non-citizens. From the Galapagos Islands to South Africa's Kruger National Park, international visitors pay more and do so willingly, knowing their contributions help protect globally significant places. Even within the United States, state parks and wildlife agencies regularly charge higher fees to out-of-state users. For Arizona's gateway communities, the long-term equation is simple. Visitors come because the Grand Canyon is safe, accessible, and unforgettable. Investing in reliable water systems, well-maintained roads, and visitor facilities protects the reputation. PERC's Yellowstone research shows that asking international visitors to contribute a little more can generate substantial resources without driving them away. The Grand Canyon is a gift to the world. It is also a responsibility. The new international visitor surcharge is not about closing the gates to global tourists. It's about keeping them open, sustaining the park, and supporting the communities that rely on this extraordinary place. That is a win for the Grand Canyon, for Northern Arizona, and for everyone who loves America's national parks. Some gifts are meant to be unwrapped. Others are meant to be conserved. This one does both. This was written by Tate Watkins, research fellow at Property and Environment Research Center, PERC, a nonprofit institute based in Bozeman, Montana, that creates innovative conservation solutions through markets and incentive. Next opinion is from Dr. Joseph V. Sakran, opinion contributor. Ice-blocking aid to wounded woman should alarm us all. I have spent my career as a trauma surgeon running toward gunshot wounds, not away from them. I've also survived one myself. Prevention is how we save most lives, and it must always be our goal. But when prevention has failed and a bullet has already torn through flesh, nothing matters more than immediate care. Seconds matter. Bleeding is relentless. Survival often hinges not on heroics, but on whether someone is allowed to do the most basic human act. Help. That is why the recent shooting in Minneapolis is so deeply disturbing, not only because a woman was killed, but also because after she was shot, a physician on the scene was prevented by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents from rendering aid. As a trauma surgeon, I find that fact chilling. In medicine, we do not ask who someone is before we treat them. We do not ask where they're from, what they believe, or whether they are deserving. We treat them because they're injured, full stop. This principle is not sentimental idealism. It's the ethical foundation of emergency medicine, trauma care, and humanitarian response worldwide. I've treated patients who've harmed others. I've cared for people in police custody, people accused of violent crimes, people whose actions I profoundly disagree with. None of that alters my obligation. When someone is bleeding in front of you, your duty is to stop the bleeding. This ethic does not end at our borders, nor does it bend to politics. Even in war, especially in war, there are rules that protect the wounded. Medics treat enemy combatants. Clinicians cross lines to render aid. These norms exist because once we decide that some injured people are unworthy of care, the concept of medicine itself begins to collapse. Preventing a physician from treating a dying woman is not merely a procedural choice, it's a moral one. As someone who has lain wounded, dependent on strangers to keep me alive, I know how thin the line is between life and death. I am alive today because people I did not know acted quickly, decisively, and without hesitation. They did not ask where I belonged. They did not wait for authorization. They simply did what was right. What happened in Minneapolis represents a rupture of that shared ethic. This is not an argument about immigration policy. Reasonable people can and do disagree about borders, enforcement, and the rule of law. But none of those debates justify denying emergency medical care to a person who has been shot. When enforcement supersedes humanity, we are not enforcing laws. We are abandoning values. The danger of moments like this extends beyond the life lost, though that loss alone should haunt us. The deeper danger is the precedent set. If armed authority can block medical care today, under what circumstances will it be acceptable tomorrow? Who decides when compassion is optional? In trauma care, we are trained to act first because delay kills. We do not debate while a patient is bleeding to death. We do not negotiate while oxygen levels fail. The failure to name moral breaches in society carries a similar cost, slower perhaps, but just as devastating. I do not know if Renee Nicole Good could have been saved. No one can say that with certainty. But she should have been given every possible chance. allowing anyone to bleed while trained help stands ready violates something older and more sacred than any statute. We must continue to fight for prevention, to reduce violence before it happens, to build systems that save lives upstream. But when violence has already occurred, the measure of a society is how it treats the wounded. Care is not a reward. It's a duty. A society is judged not only by how it enforces its laws, but also by whether it upholds its most basic obligations in moments of crisis. If we lose the commitment to treat the injured, regardless of who they are, we lose something essential. And once lost, it will not be easy to reclaim. That was written by Dr. Joseph V. Sacrin. He's a trauma surgeon and public health expert who serves as executive vice chair of surgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. He is also a survivor of gun violence and chair of Brady United. Time now for the horoscopes for today. If you're an Aries, born between March 21st and April 19th, only considering a business decision from one angle, as Mercury and Jupiter oppose, avoid allowing its potential to blind you to its reality. For Taurus, April 20th to May 20th, putting too much of on your plate, the consequences of overextension catch up with you as Mercury and Jupiter clash. For Gemini, May 21st to June 21st, glossing over the details of a deal, as Mercury and Jupiter clash, bad strategizing can lose you cash. For Cancer, June 22nd to July 22nd, confident everything will work out, your optimistic attitude complicates a negotiation as Mercury and Jupiter clash. For Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd, keeping the faith to achieve success, that's a good start, but it's only part of the equation as Mercury and Jupiter clash. Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd, does your vision have legs? As Mercury and Jupiter clash, focus on the specifics. For Libra, September 23rd to October 23rd, biting off more than you can chew, a professional ambition is top of mind as Mercury and Jupiter clash. For Scorpio, October 24th to November 22nd, as Mercury and Jupiter clash, someone challenges you to back up your faith with facts. For Sagittarius, November 22nd to December 21st, cashing in on good fortune, as Mercury and Jupiter clash, financial success is a matter of luck, not sound strategy. For Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th, you assumed your partner shared your ideas. A morning conversation reveals a disconnect. Is it worth pressing? For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th, coasting on your people skills? As Mercury and Jupiter clash, avoiding the elephant in the room can come back to haunt you. For Pisces, February 19th to March 20th, are you seeing the best in a love interest? As Mercury and Jupiter clash, you'll convince yourself to ignore the red flags. And now to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, I am a 51-year-old mother and grandmother whose kids don't talk to me. The reason? My son, Aaron, not his real name, was sexually assaulted by his friend, Eli, also not his real name, and I told him his friend was no longer allowed to come over. I spoke to Eli's mother. She told me she'd take care of it and agreed the two shouldn't hang out. They were both underage at the time. Aaron was 10 and Eli was 13. A few months later, Aaron told me that it wasn't Eli, but his own Uncle Joe, not his real name, who sexually assaulted him. I knew better. I talked to Joe, and of course he knew nothing. I told Aaron to stop lying about his uncle and that Eli still couldn't come over. Aaron is an adult now, and he's got his siblings believing him about his uncle, and he's still friends with Eli. My husband and I moved next door to Joe, and now all the kids have blocked me from their lives and the kids' lives. When I tried to talk to Aaron about the situation, he blocked me completely. Joe knows nothing about what's going on. How do I get back into my children's and grandkids' lives? Signed, Turned Upside Down. Dear Turned, Could the boys have been experimenting with getting familiar with their bodies when all this occurred? Did you see something and confront your son, and he admitted it? Aaron may have blamed Uncle Joe because he wanted to continue seeing Eli. Or was his accusation true? You'll not be able to heal the schism in your family until everyone is in agreement about what really happened when Aaron was 10. And dear Abby, my older brother, age 70, is making his estate plans with his partner. We have no other siblings or children. I told him I'm financially secure and don't need him to leave me anything, but he insisted on having my Social Security number, saying it's needed for beneficiary bequests. I called him back before disclosing the information because I wanted to make sure it was really him. He later called me and asked for my passport number because his partner has assets in China, and the paperwork required more information. That was too much information for me, and I asked him to take me out of his bequests entirely. He fussed about having to contact the lawyer and change the trust information, but said he would take care of it. Now he's no longer speaking to me. Abby, my brother never disclosed that he would need anything beyond a Social Security number. Should I feel guilty about the added expense of editing his trust? Signed, Troublemaker Sis, in Texas. Dear Sis, you should absolutely not feel guilty for refusing to reveal the information your brother was requesting. Are you sure it was your brother calling and asking for this highly personal information and not a scammer? I ask because a beneficiary's Social Security number and or passport number is not required when someone is being mentioned in a will, and I think you may have dodged a bullet. If you'd like to write to Dear Abby, you can reach her at dearabby@www.dearabby.com. And we've got time for a couple of comics. We'll start with Blondie. Dagwood sitting at the desk or kitchen table looking at papers, look like bills, and he said, and Blondie's behind him. He says, "Sweetheart, look, the balance on the credit card is finally zero. That's a beautiful thing, isn't it, honey?" Blondie says. And Dagwood turns around and says, "Why don't we celebrate by cutting up that credit card?" Blondie walks away and says, "Ideas like that will never stimulate the economy, honey." And we've reached the end of the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of a program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, under broadcast info and audio.